love the chase and the hunt, and I set the pace when I'm running. I always take what I want and I always give it 100. Don't need a bank, no, I'm funded. Play the game like it's nothing. I'm always thankful for something. Don't take for granted, stay humble. Now wake up! It's time to look at the enemy. Look in the mirror if he is no friend to me. It's not working out, maybe it's the chemistry. It's time to break up so I can make a better me. Better believe in your mind, cause it's everything. You can mold, shape, find almost anything. All it takes is some time and some clarity to find your identity. It's mind over everything.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the 70th installment of The Bobby Kuto Show.
And when I feel like this, I'm immortal. When I feel like this, I'm immortal. When I feel like this, I'm immortal. When I feel like this, I'm immortal.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the 70th episode of The Bobby Kuto Show. As promised and delivered, I have a special guest with us here today, Mr. David O'Donnell, all the way from Scotland, 3,000 miles away, made the special trip to be with us today. Brother, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome, Bobby. Nice to be here.
We have a lot to talk about. So I'm going to fade us out of here and get started. Everybody, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it. Episode 69, huge success. The listens are fantastic. The Patreon is doing amazing. And I just want to thank the audience. Without you guys, none of this exists. I'm just so humbled. I know it's been quite the journey. We've to be 70 episodes into the show and almost 3 years into this. And, you know, when I started it, it wasn't much. You know, it was just me, a computer and a microphone, you know, a USB microphone. Mm-hmm. And now here we are in the studio and, you know.
A very nice studio.
Thank you, brother. Thank you. Thousands of listens, thousands of downloads, and the support has been amazing. And for me, the show, David, the show is about evolution. You know, it's about how do you better yourself? How do you make things better for yourself? And for me, surrounding myself with people that are intelligent, people that are smart, people that are successful, people that are driven. And you, sir, you are the first nuclear physicist to be on the show. You know what I mean? Like, I just talk about like top of the mountain here. You know
There's
what I mean?
Not many of us out there. So
it's amazing to me. And you know what? I got to ask you this right off the start. Like, how do you even get there? Like, how do you wake up in the morning and say, hey, I want to be a nuclear physicist? How does that happen?
Well, it doesn't really happen quite like, as you say, but I know what you mean. So basically, when I finished high school, I went to study engineering. Didn't really enjoy it at all, so I took I spent 1 year engineering, and then I moved on to study physics, which is basically what I've always wanted to study. And I realized that when I was talking to some people who were already studying physics, and I started thinking about, I love Star Trek, and they talk about all of these cool particles, all of this cool physics, and that's what I want to do. So I then went on and studied a four-year undergraduate degree to study physics, first of all. And then following that, I did a PhD, so a further 3 years. And it's in the PhD level that you start to specialize, whether you're going to do nuclear physics, astrophysics, particle physics, you know, solid state physics, whatever type of physics you do, you spend the 3 years of your PhD doing that. And then at the end of that, you get your doctorate. And then it's just a kind of, like you were talking about, it's an evolution. So basically you move from your PhD onto some research positions, and you maybe, it's always good to travel around, go to different places, meet new people, open up your network. And then eventually you might become sort of good enough, and you might have a network which is sufficiently large, and you've got so many papers that you can then get a permanent position at a university. And basically where I find myself.
So how do you end up in nuclear? How does that happen?
At the university at which I was studying, there was a strong nuclear physics research group already there. And so I was working under the for one of my undergraduate projects, I was working under one of the head of the nuclear physics group at that, and basically he just offered me a PhD, and I really loved the guy. It was going to be studying with him. And I, of course, you're not going to say no.
Right. I mean, that's not every day somebody asks you or gives you that opportunity.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Seriously. Normally you have to, I mean, and I'm not saying it was because I was super special or something. It's just, I happened to be at the right place at the right time. But normally you have to apply for these things. Being offered one, I just thought, well, absolutely,
of
yes.
course. Yeah, you take that opportunity.
And he went on to become my PhD supervisor. This is Professor Bob Chapman. And he's still... He's been retired for about 15 years or something like this, and he still comes in twice a day.
No kidding.
Sorry, twice per week.
Yeah.
And helps to supervise the younger students and so on. And helps us. So, yeah, he's really still involved.
So now you teach? Is that what you're...
That's right.
Okay.
So my job is kind of like, I would say 40% teaching, 40% research, or research as Americans tend to call it. Yeah.
Right.
And about 20%. Sort of admin work and stuff like that. So yeah.
And so all your students, are they in the nuclear physics? Like, so that's their...
Most of the courses I teach are actually nuclear physics based. Yes, I also teach a quantum mechanics course, but yes, it's wow. Yeah. And most of the courses I teach are nuclear physics based. And then I have my own PhD student who I supervise, and he's doing a nuclear physics project. Yeah.
So let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you see the world differently now? Would you say before you started, just like us?
Yeah.
And then you gain all this knowledge,
yes.
And you see things differently, right?
Yes.
I mean, I would imagine you see things in a microscopic atomic level. So you know,
sure,
things that I'll probably never even see.
Right.
So does the world change for you? Does it look different?
Yeah, a little bit. But I think, like, again, I guess I'm going to probably come back to this. But again, like, in this evolutionary way, you just kind of build on your knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't actually necessarily notice that something has changed.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean?
Gotcha,
so I'm sure, yeah, you're right. Like, if you go back 20 years ago when I was an undergraduate student,
yeah,
of course I see the world differently now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But you don't notice it happening. There's not one instant, like, click moment,
right,
where you basically,
right,
just switch and you're then like, oh, wow, I see the world completely differently.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You just build gradually day by day,
yeah,
and you just build up your knowledge and whatever. But I'll tell you one thing that has given me, as a result of that whole process, that has changed my outlook of the world, is I'm very, very lucky in that I get to travel for my job. So we, in the UK, we tend to go to the US, to Europe, so Finland, Germany, France, this type of thing. And we go and we use these large-scale laboratories that are situated around the world.
Yep,
and
yep,
so
yep,
we go for like maybe a week or two at a time.
Yep.
And that is really eye-opening, because you not only get to see new places, but you get to meet people from all sorts of different cultures,
right,
all sorts of different walks of life.
Yeah.
And so that really is eye-opening. And so, yeah, yes, as a result of that, I can definitely see the difference, like, from me 20 years ago to now.
Yeah.
You know, my horizons have broadened,
right,
immensely.
Right,
right,
right. Well, we were talking a little bit before the show.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Nina, correct?
Yes. Nina? Yeah.
Nina, your wife, Nina.
Yeah.
She's into, like, paranormal things, right? And,
yeah,
and you, it was funny you mentioned, you're like, well, you know, I'm not really, I don't believe it.
No.
Because you think logic, you know, you have logic, and you're a numbers guy, right? So
yes,
show me, right? Show me.
Exactly.
Put it in my
evidence
face.
Evidence-based. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you could provide me evidence, and the scientific method is not just to provide evidence once, right? Because once could be a fluke.
Yep.
It's when you start having multiple instances of something happening,
right,
is when science,
right,
starts to change.
Okay.
So, and... I guess that is one way that, yes, I think that I have changed, and maybe is that, yeah, basically the scientific method is imprinted in my brain,
right?
From just years of studying and then years of teaching it to people as well. So the scientific method is deep in here, and I don't even necessarily realize it. But I need evidence when someone says something.
Yep.
And so if you're talking about spirit world or ghosts or something like this, then I'm not going to basically just say, nah, that's rubbish.
Right, right.
But I don't believe in it myself,
mm-hmm,
you know,
right,
but if I was to be then presented with consistent evidence,
yep,
multiple times, then I would change my mind.
Right.
Yeah.
But you also mentioned Star Trek, right? So
yes,
if anybody knows Star Trek, it's Gene Roddenberry and something that he wrote and put together.
Sure.
Now, do you believe that there's a possibility for warp speed? Do you believe that there's a possibility for, like, intergalactic travel? Do you think that that's possible?
Yeah, there's not really much in the laws of physics that says that that these things are impossible, right? But I'll tell you one thing is that I don't think we'll get to travel at warp speed in the way that we perhaps think about it, right?
Okay.
Because we think about a car, for example, propelling itself, or a rocket propelling itself.
Okay.
And if you were to do that, and warp speed, of course, remember, is they're traveling faster than light, right?
Yes, yes.
So the problem with that is that you can't actually... People like us can't actually travel faster than light, unfortunately. This is what Einstein told us.
Yep.
Einstein, the guy behind you,
yep,
right there.
Yep, my man.
So Einstein told us that basically as you approach the speed of light, the mass just increases. So as you reach the speed of light, your mass would be infinite. So every time you get closer and closer to the speed of light,
yep.
you get heavier and heavier, making it more and more difficult to then push yourself towards the speed of light.
Okay.
So there's this dilemma whereby we can never actually travel faster than the speed of light in our local frame. And okay. by that I mean, say for example, you were sitting in a spaceship and you certainly just can't just travel at the speed of light. But what you could potentially do, and people are actually writing papers about this, it's a long way off, is to warp. Yeah, it's to warp space-time. And so you're pulling the place that you're going to closer to you. Does that make sense?
Right.
So you could be staying in place,
yep.
but you're pulling the planet or the sun that you're going to visit that might be light years away, you're pulling it closer to you okay. rather than propelling yourself towards it.
That's amazing. That's an amazing concept. Because I've always heard even the like folding a piece of paper.
Yes.
Right? Like if you would take 2 points and fold that piece of paper and bring those 2 points together, that could be a way that we could travel long, far distances
right.
in a possible time. But then again, like you said, how do we physically do that? Like how do our bodies withstand that kind of... Right?
Yeah, yeah. No, and what you're describing there is exactly what I was talking about. Is if you imagine space-time, like that piece of paper that you're talking about, Bobby, you just basically, you bend it and you bring those 2 points closer together, exactly. And the way you would do that, perhaps, would be to... I mean, we don't fully understand gravity yet.
Okay.
This is one of the other things. We don't fully understand it. There are a lot of things about gravity that are still puzzling us.
Yep.
But for example, if we could create a mass that was large enough, mm-hmm. that could potentially bend space-time in the way that you're talking about and then bring those points closer together.
Yeah. That'd be amazing, wouldn't it?
It would be.
I mean, and look, obviously you're a logical man.
Mm-hmm.
You believe there's life out there. There has to be life out there, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, mathematically, the math just, I mean, when you think of how many thousands of galaxies there are out there, and that's what we can see.
Yeah.
And they actually just launched, what is that, Omega 3 telescope?
The James Webb telescope.
The James Webb telescope. Mm-hmm. They just launched that thing, and now we're seeing so much further. And you know what? And again, for the audience, it's not the perception of distance. It's the perception of time.
Precisely.
Right? Because, I mean, it's really about how long it takes to get to that point.
Yeah, how long the light takes to reach us.
To reach
yeah.
us, right? Because mm-hmm. we're talking billions and billions of light years.
Yes.
And how is, I mean, to me, the idea like of a black hole and having that dark energy and somehow mm-hmm. being able to travel through that. And maybe mm-hmm. it's a wormhole and
yeah.
all of these possibilities. And you're closer to that, man. Like you have a perception of that I could only dream of having. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea of being able to concept things like that at just that galactic scale.
Mm-hmm.
The universe is so vast and endless.
Yeah.
And having some type of understanding of that at an atomic level,
yeah.
that's very impressive, my man.
Okay, it really thanks.
Is. I mean, that's very, very impressive.
Yeah, but you asked about the numbers in terms of like the probability of having another race out there, right?
Yep.
We actually can actually put a number on that.
Really?
And it's called something called the Drake equation. And
okay.
it's a series of basically terms which multiply together, each giving a probability. And I forget them off the top of my head, but they're going to be something like the probability that life exists on any other planet. And so physicists or astrobiologists, they come up with these ideas and they go, well, maybe it's 1%. You know, and they can give ranges in terms of their estimates of this.
Yeah.
But then there would be another equation which would be, well, another term which would be, well, what's the probability that life form would become something like us, sentient,
intelligent,
and so on? And what would the likelihood of them being able to get through the hard times that the human race has already gone through,
right
to reach the point where they can actually start to send out signals or they can build something in space that you would be able to detect.
Right.
And so there's all of these terms.
Like a Stargate.
Yeah, exactly, like a Stargate, yeah. And there's all these terms and they all multiply together.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? They don't give you zero. The Drake equation doesn't give you a zero probability. It gives you what we call in physics a finite probability.
Okay.
That basically there is a chance. And when you look outside, I mean, the image that was just released from the James Webb telescope, Bobby, was one of the what they call the deep field image.
Okay.
It's incredible, right? You see like thousands of galaxies in this image, right?
Yeah.
And that was taken from a patch of the sky that if you stood on Earth and you held a single grain of sand up in your finger at arm's length, that's what the patch of sky looked like.
That's amazing.
And that was thousands and thousands of galaxies. And that's not us even reaching very far.
Wow.
I mean, that's like, that image was taken from something like 5 billion years after the Big Bang.
Yep.
The James Webb will be able to go even further back. There's galaxies behind those ones.
Amazing.
And so you just think, of course, it's
of course,
a no-brainer.
It's a no-brainer. There has to be. There has
absolutely.
To be. There has to be. So how about the theory here? Here we go. We're going to kind of go rabbit hole a little bit.
Okay.
So the Egyptians, right?
Yeah.
The pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
They say that there's a chance that, you know, there was some intervention there, and that somehow the pyramid was actually a tool mm-hmm. to harness energy to make light. Do you believe any of that? Do you think that's a possibility? I mean, because they've got the images, the hieroglyphics that actually show, like, you know, these flying machines, and and like, you wonder, could that be true? Could we have been maybe planted here by some other race,
right,
and said, hey, leave them alone and see what happens?
I mean, that's an interesting perspective of being planted here. I think that the fossil record tells us that it's probably not the case, and you can see the progression from essentially some salamander essentially slithering out of the ocean and then growing legs and then so
and
on
then
and so on.
And then
you see our ape cousins, and they're so close to us, and you think, yeah, that's a clear. And you can see all the different types of hominids that were evolved over time. So
there you go.
I think it's unlikely that they were planted here. And regarding the Egyptians, I would say, I feel like it's a really nice idea, but I don't see the evidence for it. Again, this is just it. And so if you've got some hieroglyphics that tend to suggest something, well, that it could be one that the author of the hieroglyphics was, let's say, he might have been high. He might have been mentally unstable.
Absolutely.
Or we might be misinterpreting it too.
Agreed.
And or it might even have been just a story they were telling, right? Yeah. So
see, I was testing you on that one because I wanted to see, because the science obviously points to what you said, evolution. And I was curious to see if maybe, you know, there's some type of little, just maybe a chance that, you know, could it be? Could it possibly be that we kind of were something else? And, you know, I know that's a tough question to answer, because you almost destroy God when you say that God doesn't exist. You know what I mean? A lot of people won't conceive that concept just because of that reason. But when you're talking science and evolution, I absolutely agree with you 100%. I do believe that we come out of the ocean and or wherever it was, and we evolved into what we are today.
Yeah.
I think it's a beautiful and amazing thing that we have evolved into this intelligent, although scary, but intelligent being.
Yeah.
And I think the intelligence for us goes in two directions. One, you can create beautiful things, and you can look at the world in amazing ways. And then all of a sudden, you can create things that aren't so beautiful. You know, Einstein, and you know the harnessing nuclear power in itself.
Yeah.
The idea of being able to produce clean energy and provide the world with free clean energy, which hasn't happened yet, but hopefully someday it will.
Right.
But the other side of that coin is you got nuclear weapons, and you have the ability to, you know, catastrophic damage on an epic level.
Absolutely.
How do you feel about that? How does that? I mean, because it's a contradiction in both, right?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the greatest minds of our existence.
Yes.
And you almost accidentally create something that could ultimately just destroy our existence inherently. So how do you feel about that? How does that?
Yeah, it's a great question, Bob. I mean, I would say that I think that you're right in the sense that there is this double-edged sword, isn't there? Like, in terms of, like, yes, they opened Pandora's box when, for example, they first realized that, well, you could convert this much mass into energy according to E=mc², right?
Yep, yep.
Now, so, and you're right that they quickly realized, I mean, this was the thing, is that, yeah, the Manhattan Project, I mean, they realized it because we were in a time of real strife at the beginning of the 20th century, right?
Yep,
you know,
yep.
That first half of the 20th century is just marked with, you know, two world wars.
Absolutely.
Spanish war, basically. You know, you've got all of these wars going on all around the world. And so, yeah, I think it's unfortunate, but it's only inevitable that their first idea was to, well, let's see if we can harness that to build a bomb, right?
Right.
To do damage to our enemies. So
that's
really unfortunate. And personally, I would be happy if we got rid of all the nuclear warheads in the world. But at the same time, yes, we do perhaps have a way now of, as you said, nuclear fusion. Unfortunately, it always seems to be just over the horizon. It was when I was a student 20 years ago,
and
it still is now. But there are some really exciting projects.
Yeah,
so, for example, one happening in the US here in the ignition facility. There's one in a place called Cadarache in France. And then there's one in the UK, for example.
Yeah.
And these facilities are really exciting. They do potentially offer a clean source of from fusion.
Yep.
That's basically recreating the nuclear reactions that take place in the sun or stars, you know, stars all around the around the universe.
Yep.
But we just harness those. We could potentially have this really nice source, because you can take the material from seawater, right? You can take the deuterium that you need from seawater. You can create the tritium that you need in the reactor itself, and it produces very little to no long-term radioactive waste.
So the difference is, right, just real quick, is the reaction, right?
Yes.
In one, you're exploding. Exactly. And the other one, you're not. Am I correct?
You're bringing things together.
You're bringing together.
Exactly, yeah. So fishing is the sort of the conventional one which we use throughout the world currently to create power, right? I mean, for example, in the UK, we rely on nuclear fishing for 20% of our energy.
Okay.
I don't know what the figure is in the US, but in France, it can be like up to 80% of their energy. So these are really, you know, they're very important parts in terms of the energy budget of many of these countries.
Right.
But you're right, like when you take something that's inherently unstable, and then it just basically you give it a slight nudge, right? You fire something called a neutron at it,
okay,
and you give it a slight nudge, you give it a tiny bit of energy, and because it's so unstable, it just explodes apart.
Okay.
And the explosion part produces all of the energy, and you get a lot of energy. You know, it's so much more efficient in terms of energy production rather than coal, gas, oil, all of this. It's so much more efficient.
Right.
But as a result of this, you do end up with long-term radioactive waste, which you then have to deal with. You either bury it underground, and of course, lots of communities are understandably unhappy about that, having to live and share their land with this.
Sure.
But then, yes, you're right. In the one which is always on the horizon, but was hopefully closer now than ever before, is this idea of bringing two small particles together and causing them to basically combine.
So,
and that's what happens in the sun.
So what's, is it unstable? Is that why it doesn't work? What's the reason why we can't?
So at the moment, what you have, I mean, in the sun, for example, where these reactions happen all the time, individually, these reactions are actually still really they're unlikely to happen. You have to produce a lot of energy. You have to give them a lot of kinetic energy to bring them together.
Yeah.
And then they've got this mutual like sort of repulsion that keeps them apart.
Okay.
So you've got to apply huge temperatures and huge pressures to basically force them to come together. And at the moment, and all the way, you know, since the nuclear fusion research first started, we are putting in more energy than we're getting out. We can do these reactions.
We can make
these reactions. But at the moment, at the moment we're in the negative. So we're in the red at the moment. And then, but through different technologies that have been developing over 40 years or so, they're getting closer and closer to basically breaking even. And then once you get into the black in terms of energy, you start producing more than you're putting in. That's us.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And that will change the world.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine like these countries that don't have anything, that don't have the, you know, where now you don't want certain countries to have this nuclear energy, this nuclear power, because obviously, like Iran, they're going to use it for purposes that are less than peaceful.
Yes.
You know, if you could have that and you could provide that to people, I mean, I think it, you know, I understand solar and wind. I think that's, again, part of the, I think the theme of this episode is evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we learn that although they're very, very good, it's almost like it's a good backup. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's not a good source of a primary source. I mean, not too long ago, probably 2 years ago, I don't know if you heard, in Texas, they had a huge ice storm. Texas doesn't normally get ice or snow or rain.
Yeah.
Well, all of their energy is solar power, wind power, and all of that ice and snow, it just froze everything.
Yeah.
And now you've got a whole state. Texas is one of the largest states in the United States,
right?
Nobody has any power, no energy, and there's nothing you can do. The only thing you can do is wait for this shit to melt. Otherwise, you don't have anything.
Yeah.
So I think it really opened the eyes to a lot of people to realize that, you know what? We can't just get rid of nuclear power.
Sure.
You know, there is a need. There's a huge need. And like you said, a lot of neighborhoods like, oh, I like nuclear power, but I just don't want it in my backyard.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You could have it. I just don't want it in my backyard. But unfortunately, it's one of those situations where, you know, I think if you can manage it responsibly, you know, and obviously, you know, nuclear waste is how many hundreds of thousands of years before it can actually be taken. But I think what you realize is that there's a need for that. There's an absolute need for energy. And I think, although coal and fossil fuels, I mean, it's what our primary source of energy is now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that at some point, you know, with people like you and brilliant minds that are, you know, able to concept some of these amazing ideas at a microscopic level, at an atomic level, to me, it's absolutely amazing. Like, I can't even wrap my head around it. You know what and I'm always looking forward to the future. I'm looking forward to the Star Trek. I'm looking forward to the idea that we're going to leave this planet one day and that we're going to be able to just travel the galaxy and just, you know what, be another race among the rest of the universe. You know what I mean? Imagine what that would be like. Imagine, you know, 200 years from now, 300 years from now, what do we look like? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What are we evolving into?
Right, that would be.
Because we're not that old. You know,
people think
we've been here forever. We haven't been here very long.
As a human race, we've been here for a couple of tens of thousands of years, you know?
Right. It's just, how long have we been here at an intelligent level?
Yeah,
right?
It's even shorter.
I mean, seriously, like even our country, like 200 plus years, just understanding that and concepting that. And I think, unfortunately, you've got a generation now that I don't know that they're attached to that. I don't know that they see the sun every day. I don't know that they're motivated enough to say, hey, I'm going to spend this much time on my education and bettering myself so that I can change mankind. I can make a difference in the world. Not just flipping hamburgers and serving French fries, but to say, I want to change mankind. I want us to be smarter. I want us to be greater. And listen, just to kind of change the subject a little bit, because I mean, we could be talking about this forever.
Yeah.
Scotland. We got to talk about Scotland
for a minute. Okay, yeah.
So you're born and raised in Scotland.
That's right.
Okay, whereabouts exactly in Scotland?
So I was born in a place in the west of Scotland called Greenock. So it's spelled like G-R-E-E-N-O-C-K, Greenock. Okay,
Greenock.
And a lot of people who don't come from Scotland call it Greenock, right? Okay. But it's Greenock. I want to make that clear.
Yeah, right.
So, but that's a little town of maybe something like 50,000 people, or so 55,000 people, something like that.
Okay.
What it used to be was a much larger town. It used to be basically one of the global centers for shipbuilding. We've got a long, long heritage of shipbuilding on what we call the Firth of Clyde.
Okay.
So the River Clyde runs from almost like the center of Scotland all the way out to the Atlantic Ocean, essentially.
Oh, wow. So you got a waterway that goes all the way out.
Yeah, a lot of
way.
Yeah. It's still not as big as your rivers here in this country, but it's pretty big. And then it widens when it gets to Greenock. Okay. And this allowed for a lot of really big, powerful shipyards to be situated there. For example, have you heard of the QE2, the Queen Elizabeth?
Okay, yeah.
So that was built, basically, it was built in a place just up the river from where I'm from called Clyde Bank, and it was then finished in Greenock. So this massive massive liner, which would then go on for decades. I believe it's still probably in service. And this was built by, I guess, my predecessor. So, you know, people like my granddad, my father, they were all shipbuilders.
That's cool.
Unfortunately, the shipbuilding went elsewhere. So it didn't become it. It was no longer economical to pay these people. People were becoming very expensive. Yeah, so it went elsewhere in the world. So places like Greenock, my hometown, went in a bit of decline as a result of that. But now I live in a place called Glasgow, which is the biggest city in Scotland, and it sits basically on the Clyde.
Okay.
So I'm only about 25, maybe 30 miles from my hometown.
Okay.
But it's a big metropolis of about 800,000 people, something like that.
No kidding. Wow. Now, you mentioned is it like Fall River, Mass? Is that what you...
Greenock, I liken to Fall River.
Okay.
Right?
So those Greenock, two are like the same.
Yes.
Because a lot of the audience that listen, they're from Fall River, Mass.
Sure,
so they'll be able to relate
I see a lot of similarities between Fall River and Greenock, right? They're both, in my opinion, they're both like very working class towns.
Yep.
I know that it's a city.
But I see,
Greenock is a town, but it's only a town because we differentiate between towns and cities differently than you guys do here in the US. I see Fall River and Greenock in a lot of similarities, both working class places.
Yep, yep.
They've both got a heritage which I would say is in decline through one way or another, right? And I think in Fall River it would be the mills, right?
Absolutely, yep. The textile industry. Yep. That when the textile industry kind of faded out, I'll tell you a true story. My mom was in the textile industry working for Quaker Fabric.
Yes.
They employed over 5,000 people. They went on vacation they used to shut down for 2 weeks in July.
Mm-hmm.
They came back, there was a sign on the door.
Oh.
Shut down for business. They went down to unemployment and filled out. That was it. It was over. So you had 5,000 people all at once that lost their jobs. So that was a huge impact to the city. Although others followed, the textile industry kind of went over India and kind of just everything moved. It's funny because I was working for a company, a textile company that would go in and liquidate.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually liquidating all these mills. So I got to see this firsthand going in and seeing all this equipment and all this and shipping it all overseas. Just all of it was getting loaded, crated, and shipped out. And they didn't care what condition the equipment was in. They wanted it.
Right.
You know, they were building the Coast Madness, which actually do like the waistband elastics and
knitters
and all of this equipment, sewing machines. And it was like just hundreds and thousands of pieces that none of it got thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
It all got shipped overseas.
Right.
And we lost that industry in Fall River. And I think over the years, they've made the adjustments. You know what I mean? There's a lot of new restaurants, a lot of like commerce that came in to kind of supplement a lot of that. But Fall River, born and raised, was never recovered fully from that because you had a generation of people. Like, for example, my mom, immigrants from Portugal,
yes,
came in. They bought a three-family home. They were working in the textile industry. That was their life. And as they got older, you know, us, the kids, we didn't keep those houses. Mm. A lot of us just kind of, okay, the parents pass, we sell the house, and we're moving out to where I am now, out in
right.
Berkeley. You kind of go out to this little town, you get a little single-family house, and you almost move out of the city.
Sure.
Although you've got a generation of people that stay behind, I mean, what is it? What is it you're doing? And most of it, you're traveling. You know what I mean? So I think Fall River's up and coming again. I think they're doing real well.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, one of the things I think has started to really, I can see is clear separation between like Greenock and Fall River is that I don't think, you know, I for example, in this trip I've been on, I went to Pier 52, the restaurant, right?
Yeah.
Down by the waterfront.
Yeah, down by the waterfront.
And I've been to the Cove as well, you know, and so these places are like, I mean, they're not like high end like we're talking about like in Manhattan here or
something, but they're like
$20 a plate or something like that, right? They're nice places, but that type of thing wouldn't really fly in Greenock, I don't think.
That's funny because that's exactly where I was going.
And because I think that the people where I come from generally are a little bit poorer, I would say, but I think it's not because of like necessarily a comparison between Greenock and Fall River.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's this area surrounding Fall River, and this is coming back to your point.
Yeah.
People move out and they bring some of the wealth outside of that, but it's thankfully coming back in now,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
Now, whereas I think in Greenock, for example, most people who maybe move out, like myself, they just go to Glasgow and then that's it. They stay in Glasgow and there's nice restaurants in Glasgow and so on.
Right.
And
there's
no reason to leave. Exactly. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying there aren't nice restaurants in Greenock. If anyone's happens to be listening to this, I'm not saying that at all. But I'm just saying that like something like $20 a plate probably wouldn't fly in Greenock, right?
Yeah, right.
You
know,
so
that's
I'm starting to see a bit of a difference, and I think that's exactly what you've identified, which is this sort of gentrification, let's say, of the waterfront, taking over many of these warehouses, all these older buildings.
Repurpose.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I was in the Canned Heat Brewery, for example, the other day, and basically, you just see, this was probably a boatyard, right, that someone's just converted into a brewery, and you think, that's smart.
It's brilliant.
That's smart.
It's brilliant, and it still has the nostalgia.
Exactly.
You know, you still get that waterfront feel, and you get to go outside. You can be outside. You're by the water. Just all of that, I think. And really, for years and years and years, that waterfront was just—it was almost forgotten. Like they just left it alone. We've got the battleship down there. We've got that whole museum. We've got the carousel, and it just kind of just whittled away. There was nobody going down there. And now you've got a generation of people that have said, "Hey, listen, we want to invest," and they have. They come in. They're real estate investors. They say, "Listen, waterfront property anywhere is worth its weight in gold."
Sure.
You know what I mean? People will come to be by the water.
Yeah.
And they're in this process, like you said, Pier 52, Tipsy, there's the Cove down there,
my favorite bar in the whole world, the Tipsy Seagull.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
Shout out to them and get a free plug. You know what I mean? It is a great place though.
It is.
I mean, just great atmosphere,
it's unique.
Great people.
Yeah, my friends, Tavares brothers, Craig and Eric, they took me there many years ago, and I've loved it ever since.
No kidding.
Yeah.
How many times have you visited? Have you come often?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, COVID stopped that for a bit, so this is the first time we've been back in 5 years.
Oh, wow.
And so you see, like, the family that we have here, like, completely changing, and you're like, oh, I wish I could have come here, you know, but I think this is my sixth time visiting. So it was before COVID. It was on the frequency of either once per year or once every 2 years, depending on our hosts and their availability.
What's a flight like from Scotland? How long does that take?
It takes about in total, I would say, and that's including like a stopover to change. It'll probably take about 11 or 12 hours. But the actual flight, if you went direct, would be something like 7.5.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah,
that's not bad.
No, it's not bad at all.
Considering, right? I mean, you're crossing the ocean. I mean, that's not bad at all.
No, it's not.
Speaking of ocean, I didn't know this. Scotland has over 900 islands, 95 of which occupy, with over 100,000 people living on these 95 islands.
Right.
I looked at the map because obviously did some research before you came
in. Sure,
I want to see what I'm looking at here. And shame on me. Like, I had no idea. So, I mean, I could imagine that is prime real estate, right? You want to live on an island? Is that really like...
Yeah, the difference I think between like Scotland and the US here, Bobby, is that in Scotland, most of the land is owned already by people, and it's like legacy owning, right?
Okay.
And many of these people are actually outside of the country.
Really?
So you can't really go and just buy a piece of land like you can do here. right? So you can't just identify a nice place to live and just go and buy a piece of land.
Really?
You know, I know you can do it here because I have friends and family who have done this.
Of course,
you know?
Yeah, right.
And you can do it in Finland where I spend a lot of my professional life as well. You can just say, I'm going to build a house on this patch of land.
Yeah.
But in Scotland, it's not. It's whether it be through, like, for example, the monarchy of the UK owning parts of the land or these what we call lairds. So they're basically lords. The Scottish word for lord, I should say the Scots word for lord is laird.
Okay.
And these lairds will just own huge pieces of land and they might use them for hunting or something like this, and they're never going to give it away.
That's it, right. Yeah. Right.
Well, and if they did, it would be for an absolute premium. So what happens is that you get people like Russian oligarchs. Mm-hmm. I mean, up until very recently, right? But they're not coming now and buying land in Scotland, I'll tell you that much.
Right.
But basically, the Russian oligarchs, people like this were coming and buying pieces of land in Scotland as well. But the people of Scotland cannot buy this land. Mm-hmm. It is way too pricey.
You know what? I got to be honest with you. That's not such a bad thing. And I always say that because when I think of places like New York City, which is prime real estate. I mean, that's, if you think about prime real estate in the world, that's prime real estate.
Absolutely.
And we don't own any of it. It's all owned by people from other countries.
Yes.
China being one of those number one real estate owners in New York. So it's almost like you kind of lose that to other forces, and whether they want it or not, or just want to hold it, it's kind of like the same idea. You got the land and you're never going to sell it again. And now you get that prime real estate at a premium. And it's almost unfortunate because now what?
Now you
don't even have a chance. Like, if I wanted to, I couldn't even try.
No.
If I couldn't, you know what I mean? It wouldn't happen.
You know, my wife and I, we make a decent living.
Yep.
We're not wealthy by any means, but we make a decent living. But we could never afford to buy a piece of land in Scotland.
Right.
Not a chance.
No kidding.
I could save my whole life and I'd probably never be able to buy
that's
a piece
amazing.
Of land.
That's amazing. I can't believe that. Like, that's absolutely amazing.
It's the truth. Yeah,
wow.
Honestly.
Wow. That's just, to me, it's almost outside of my realm of thinking because, like you said, here, you see something, you make an offer, they're going to sell it. I mean, even if you had a little bit, you're a little wealthy and you say, hey, listen, I'll pay you 10% above what anybody else is, okay, well, people are going to sell it to you. You can buy it.
Sure.
I mean, somebody offered me that for this house. I'd be like, oh, here you go, take it away.
Yeah.
So the idea that you couldn't even get your hands on a piece of land there, that's amazing.
It is. But I mean, these islands in themselves, though, they're absolutely stunning.
Okay.
Right? They're stunning.
I was looking at pictures.
It's absolutely stunning.
It's like Lord of the Rings.
It really is.
Just when you look at it and you say to yourself, that place actually exists.
Yeah.
It's not just a movie.
I only wish Peter Jackson had come to Scotland to film and not his native New Zealand, right?
Because
we could have made some bucks, we could have made bank doing that. But yeah, no, these islands are amazing. And the other thing they give us, if you're a whiskey drinker, I don't know if you are or you're not, but a lot of these islands give us many of the famous whiskeys that people will know.
Like?
So, for example, like Islay whiskey, very famous for being a very strong peaty whiskies.
Yep.
Many of these islands, they add peat to the whiskey while they're making it, and so you get that strong, almost medicinal taste to it that many people like. I myself, I'm not a fan.
Yeah, yeah.
You get that smokiness that comes from these West Coast island whiskies.
Yeah.
And that happens all the way up to, for example, the Hebrides. This is in the top left-hand corner of Scotland if you were looking at it on a map.
Okay.
But all the way up, you've got beautiful islands. The island of Skye kind of just juts out from the mainland. It is absolutely stunning. Take my word for it. Yeah, it's a beautiful place to visit.
Wow. And when are we talking population in a place like that?
Places like that, they're probably making up something like the 50,000 of that 100,000 that you said, something like that, right?
But
the island of Skye is like is a big landmass. I mean, not in terms of like the US,
right.
But it's
a big
part of Scotland, and the people there are spread out so sporadically, you know, in little hamlets, we call them, little rural villages, right?
They're
even smaller than villages, these places. They're maybe like one or two houses or a farm or something like that, but they're so spread out across the whole of that
time stopped, right?
Yeah, like many places,
Like, when I was looking at that, I'm like, that's just beautiful, so picturesque, and you wonder, like, these people are just enjoying life every day.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's no... Who cares?
Yeah.
Right? Who cares?
And much of our history is on these islands as well, so you'll find, like, standing stones. So these standing stones would have been used by either Neolithic people, so they would be used maybe for rituals or to mark the passage of time. You know, like they might have something like Stonehenge.
Like Stonehenge, right.
The more famous example. But you've got these stone circles all the way up the islands in the west of Scotland. And then you've got really, really beautiful natural features like the mountains.
You're right. Right.
It's just a beautiful place.
Wow.
I'm not taking any money from Visit Scotland here, but I'm not a shill for the tourist industry.
I'd love
but
to see
it's,
it, man.
But it is. I would highly recommend it.
I'd love to see it. I would love to see it. Mm. I mean, my parents from Portugal, a little different, you know, the Iberian Peninsula, but still that mountainous kind of the ocean. Right. You got that same.
Well, I visited the Algarve, and I love the Algarve. It was beautiful. I love the cliffs that basically just like drop straight. Straight off, right? And then you've got like a beautiful little seafood restaurant that's just almost hanging off off the cliff.
Right.
And then what I love about those is I think the limescale cliffs, I'm not sure exactly, but basically the sea has eaten away at a lot of those cliffs. So you end up with these beautiful like arc structures, you know, that are going into the ocean. It's so picturesque in the Algarve as well.
And just millions of years of just erosion.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can never just duplicate that. Ever again.
No.
And Scotland has a lot of that as well, too.
Yeah,
right? The island is just being eroded, and you've got this beautiful, picturesque just scenery, man. It's just peaceful.
Definitely.
How many generations in Scotland for you?
That's a good question. We don't really, I have to say, I don't really know. Because, so my name, many people might have recognized as O'Donnell.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an Irish name, which comes from like the west coast of, basically the northwest of the island that contains Northern Ireland and Ireland.
Okay.
And it comes from a place called Donegal. So the O'Donnell comes from Donegal, basically. And Donegal is named after a king of that area. So... yeah, it's one of my.
You get some royal blood. You get some royal blood in there. I didn't know I had royalty in here.
Working class royalty. Yeah. but basically that I think they moved over probably sometime in either the 18th century or the 19th century. They moved over for various reasons. One of them might have been, like, for example, the potato famine that occurred in Ireland, and that it meant that basically huge numbers of people left Ireland to go to the US. A lot of them, and a small number of them went to places in England, for example, and a smaller number of them went to places in Scotland. But it was a mass exodus due to that, due to the people who were dying from this awful hunger that happened because their crops failed.
So
I can't actually locate exactly. I've not really gone out of my way yet, but I know that we are at least third generation that are basically like Scottish, but where the Irish part of our family comes, I don't know. I'll maybe one day in 20 years time or something when I'm retired and bored, I might go and look into it a little bit, but at the moment I'm happy to just
How old are you the first time you visited the US?
Oh, good question. So I was probably like something around, so it was during my PhD, I came to Chicago. There's a wonderful nuclear physics laboratory called Argonne National Laboratory, which is situated just maybe like, I don't know, something like 10 miles west of the downtown Chicago area.
Okay.
And I visited there. And then I also, during my PhD, I visited Yale in New Haven, where there used to be a nuclear physics laboratory. It's no longer there, unfortunately. But so that would probably be me in the region of 24 or something like that.
So 24, you're an adult. You're
yes,
an adult with experience.
Absolutely, yeah.
What was your impression when you came here to the US?
Yeah, good question. So, I mean, I've always loved the US, right? I love the food. I love the portions, right?
Everything's big here.
And the diversity of the cuisine as well, because of, you know, you've got so much diverse culture here from immigration, from like, you know, from all the way from basically, you know, when Plymouth Rock and so on, you've got multiple waves of different types of immigration, and they bring with them their culture and they bring with them their food, and then that food becomes part of the US culture,
Absolutely.
And so I love the idea of basically you can go to this little Mexican restaurant over here or a beautiful little Italian restaurant here. And you know, I love that. So I've always loved that. But the one thing that always sticks in my brain was when I was in New Haven, I was staying in a hotel downtown in New Haven. And I was quite naive at the time, and I came downstairs, and I was a smoker at the time. I haven't been for many years now, but I was a smoker at the time, and it was a non-smoking room, so I came outside my hotel, and I was having a cigarette, and then a chap came by with a shopping cart, you know, and he was looking in the trash cans to put things into a shopping cart. I had only seen this in movies,
And
then I started thinking about, basically, that some of the wealthiest people in the world were sending their kids to this town to go and study.
Right.
But downtown were some of the poorest people I had ever seen in my entire life.
True, true.
And this really, this dichotomy between these two worlds really kind of stuck with me.
Yeah.
And I don't see it so much. I don't see it everywhere in the US, right?
Right, this was.
Yeah, I don't really see it in when I come to Raynham, Massachusetts or something like that, right?
Yes, yes.
I'm not saying that it's like it's throughout the country, but that was one of the things that stuck with me early on was basically, yes, they've got this really clear... you've got one extreme. You've got very wealthy people, and you've got extraordinarily poor people.
Absolutely,
and that's different in Scotland.
Yeah,
yeah, we've got a much more socialist look on take on things.
Okay,
and the population. Well, we still have a lot of poor people and a lot of hungry people, and we have wealthy people. Well, I just explained most of our land is owned by these people.
Yep, yep.
But basically, we have a much. I would say we have less of the extremes.
Right.
We don't have as many billionaires, and we don't have as many people who are in basically, you know, they're essentially dying because they don't have food, they don't have a home,
Nothing. They either drugs or it's a very unfortunate.
We have big drug problems in Scotland.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, see, in Scotland, like marijuana is not even legal, right? Like
no.
They just like, nothing's. They are no go for anything.
No,
right? Just no go.
No, and I don't know. I don't see it changing anytime soon.
Yeah.
I think that the UK is so backward when it comes to things like marijuana. I can see the effects that it has on people that I know here.
I
personally know, and they partake of this substance that I guess nature gave us.
Yeah.
You know, and we discovered that it had some medicinal benefits, and it had some really cool. Effects as well.
Yes, yes.
And I don't think the people in the UK, the politicians in the UK are so backward, it's incredible.
Wow.
So when I look at what's happening in the US, I'm not only jealous of it, but I'm also looking at it going, why aren't we taking advantage of this?
Right.
When I first seen the amount of tax that Colorado brought in that first year,
this is
what the people in Mass were looking at. They went, wow, we are getting a bit of this, right?
Absolutely.
And we should be looking at this too. Scotland could benefit enormously from this.
Right.
Marijuana is a widely used drug in Scotland, but it's illegal. And so you got all of these people who are either they're just like they're teenagers and they're kind of pushing boundaries, and they're getting maybe like, you know, they're getting into trouble with the police because they've got a small amount of marijuana.
For the rest of their lives, they've got this black spot on their record because they dabbled with marijuana.
And they were never going to go any further than this.
Right,
they were never going to move on to class, as we call them, class A drugs, things like cocaine and heroin and things like that. But then also, I think that we could take advantage of this medicinally, you know? So many people could benefit from this.
Absolutely. See, to me, the huge contradiction is alcohol.
Mm.
You know, because we obviously know the effects of alcohol, the long-term effects of alcohol. So how is it you can allow one and you don't allow the other when you look at the end result? You know, I'll be honest with you. I've never met someone who died from marijuana.
Mm.
I don't know anyone who was addicted to marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, those alcohol, I can say both. You know, I know people that I loved that I've lost. And I know people that I loved and don't like anymore because of alcohol.
Too.
Like, there's so many, you know, and again, I'm not that I'm anti-alcohol because I'm not. I mean,
no.
I like to have a drink myself, but it's either one or the other. And my personal opinion, not to get too political, is I think you just got to let people do what people want to do. I think the idea that, you know, the governments take so much control over what we do daily, and even to the sense, you know, and it was crazy. I was walking the other day and I was thinking about it to myself. And I'm like, you know what? The idea that there's a law that I need to put my kid in a car seat is insulting. Because as a parent, as an adult, I'm going to do whatever I can to keep my child safe.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I need the government to intervene and punish me if I do not?
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that as a parent, I should be doing this anyway.
Right.
So what right does the government have to implicate or to get involved in the decisions that I'm making? And should it be that decision where if I'm not putting my child in a car seat, that's detrimental to me as a parent.
Sure.
So writing a fine, well, putting me in jail doesn't help my child.
Yes. I know what you mean. But I would say, Bobby, that you're coming at it from a perspective of a good, successful parent, right?
Right.
And I think that my feeling is that unfortunately you do have to legislate at a certain point for the people in the culture who are not going to be like that, right?
Right.
Because you've got to avoid those people, those unfortunate deaths that might occur to innocent children.
Yep.
Because you get people around us who are not... they're not on the ball like you are. They're not thinking about their kids. They're more inclined to just get to their destination quickly, and so they don't put them in a car seat because, you know. So I think that I understand what you're saying, but I would say that the politicians do actually have to legislate for the people who are going to, you know, misuse the liberties that they've got.
Right.
So yeah, but that's my feeling. But I think you're right in terms of the marijuana stuff. I think it's spot on. It's just basically let people do what they want.
Yep.
And I think we should go one step further. And this is happening to a certain extent now in Scotland, whereby we've had traditionally a big heroin issue. Okay.
All right.
Yep. And it's actually moving towards like more like injection of cocaine.
Mm.
I just seen a really interesting documentary the other day from Vice that was set in Glasgow, saying that Glasgow is now the cocaine capital of the world. Would you believe it? Right, my town where I live, right,
amazing.
My city where I live.
Amazing.
Now the thing is that if we offer these addicts the ability to basically go into a clean facility to inject themselves in a safe environment, then let's do that.
Right.
If people are going to choose to do these drugs, let's allow them to do it safely.
Rather than throw needles on the ground, they're in the park, kids are seeing
going
that.
To dodgy people to buy their fix.
Yep.
Let's have them going to facilities where they can buy the fix at a reasonable price and not be subjected to any of the and this is what's happening now with marijuana, right?
Right.
You're no longer going to your dealer, you're going to the dispensary and they're basically then giving you exactly what you want
regulated.
At a fair price.
It's regulated.
Exactly. And you're not getting into all sorts of problems that you would have had in the past, right?
Do you feel that because your hometown is the capital, do you think it was related to losing the boating industry and the shipbuilding industry, it almost kind of, you come into that decline and then, you know, you got to find a way to make money. Like you need to, do you think that kind of maybe supplemented
that
in?
I mean, I don't know this for certain, but I would predict that you could find exactly an anti-correlation between basically employment increasing and it would be a correlation in this case, employment increasing and drug use increasing, you know? Because when people are long-term unemployed, what are they going to do?
They find a way
to get through the day.
Absolutely.
And that's alcohol abuse and or hard drug abuse, right?
Right.
And that I agree with you. Yeah, I think that is probably one of the reasons why.
Yep.
And it's the loss of the shipbuilding industry. And for a long time, we had something that substituted for that, IBM. So the American company, IBM, they had a plant in my hometown, Greenock. And it was very successful and employed thousands of people in the area.
Yep.
But unfortunately, again, they sold that on to, IBM sold that part of the business onto a Chinese company.
Okay.
And then they took they said, well, we don't have a need for the facility here. Let's move it back to, you know, China where we can have cheaper labor and so on. So that closed down again. So you've got this double hit of basically, you know, people losing their jobs twice now. So people who had been employed in the shipbuilding industry had maybe worked their way up and got to, you know, senior management positions in this facility and then that shut down. So you can only imagine that. For people who don't get themselves some sort of education or some sort of set of skills through an apprentice, places like this, it's kind of bleak.
Yeah, if you don't have a trade, then what are you doing? Really, what are you doing?
If you don't have a trade or you don't have a degree, you don't have a college certificate, you know what? It's tough. And so what are you going to do? You're just going to turn to some substance abuse, probably.
Yeah. Wow. So let me ask you real quick.
Yeah.
Friends, your friends.
Yes.
Do you still have a lot of the same friends that you had when you were younger? I mean, I would imagine that your career would probably maybe drive you in a different direction and maybe you kind of lose touch with a lot of people.
You may think that, but no, I do have the same group of friends that I had 20 years ago. And one of the reasons for that is that while we were all students, we all worked at McDonald's together.
That's awesome,
okay? So we all flipped burgers together.
Yeah,
and
I
met my wife at McDonald's.
Yeah.
She worked there, I worked there, and we had this amazing group of friends, and it must have been one of the most educated group of McDonald's employees in the world, I think, because half of the employees were essentially part-time,
yeah.
and we were all studying different degrees, you know, whether it be engineering or something like that, physics, whatever it may be, and so we all ended up being fairly successful in our careers.
What do you think drove that? What empowered you guys to do that? Was it that you could see what was happening around you and you kind of knew that?
I think so. And I think a lot of it's to do with parents. Mm. So for example, like neither of my parents ever went to, you know, what you call college, what we call university. Neither of my parents did. My uncle did. He was the first in our family, but that was it. And he was like a legend, you know, because he did this.
Right.
And so no one else in our family ever had done this. And so my father and my mother would be like, you know, you're going to university, you know, that's it. It's basically like the whole of my high school would be like, you're going to university. Don't care what you do,
right?
But you're going to get yourself a degree because you're going to get out of here. You're going to do better than us, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that I just happened to meet a lot of people who were doing the same thing. And McDonald's was a great place to work for that because they just said, well, what do you want? Do you want to work weekends only? Fine, come and do that with us, you know?
Right.
And so we met like-minded people and we've continued those friendships.
And that helped you, that must have motivated you, right? Because you're all sharing that same experience.
Exactly,
It's not like all your friends are going out drinking all night because, well, they have an exam too and they have to study. And you're kind of like all in that same, wow, that's amazing, man. What a cool story. And David, I hope you're not offended by this, but you are one of the most regular guys I've ever met in my life. Like, it's so refreshing. Like, if you didn't tell me, I would never know.
Sure.
You know, because normally you think, well, nuclear physicist, I can't even have a conversation with that person. That's the perception that, you know, maybe on that level of intellect and conversation, I couldn't do it. But here we are, man. And it's just, I'm so impressed and just like,
I'm
flattered, man. I'm absolutely flattered.
I'm really flattered to have this conversation with you, Bob. It's really nice. I really enjoy it. And in my line of work, I do meet a lot of people who are kind of like there. Maybe not as sociable as I am, let's say, right? And they might fight the stereotype that you've got in your brain if you meet a nuclear physicist, right?
Right.
But no, I don't know. I just a normal guy who basically ended up studying something I just love nuclear physics. I love physics in general.
Yeah.
I love nuclear physics, and I get up every day. I love going to my job.
That's awesome.
And you know, and my wife will tell you that if you ask her that, basically I spend way too much time doing my job. You know, it's not work.
It's not work.
I sit there with my laptop, and she's like, "Oh, watch the TV show," and I'm like, "No, I'm doing something." You know, and I'm working.
Yeah.
But I love it.
You know, when I say it on the show all the time, if you do what you love, you don't work a day in your life.
Yes.
And that's always the message, is telling everybody who's listening, listen, do what you love.
Yeah.
There's no reason why you couldn't or why you shouldn't do what you love. And if it means investing some time to say, hey, listen, I do need a degree or I do want to do this, then do it.
Yeah, right. And I guess that's what you've done, Bobby, right? In this podcast, right? Yep. You're now doing what you love, right?
Absolutely.
Because otherwise, I guess we wouldn't be sitting here in a Thursday evening, right, talking to one another about this.
Right.
But I guess you've done the same thing, is that you've not only gone out and got yourself the skills that you needed in order to do this, but you've went and invested in the equipment.
Yeah, right.
And then you've invested in the time. And you can tell in the same way that you're seeking out guests. You know, we just happened to meet the other evening, right?
Like the universe brought us together,
exactly,
brother.
Exactly, yeah, right. Exactly.
Yes.
And you're just seeking out guests and so on. So you're clearly putting in a lot of time yourself.
Absolutely.
But I imagine it's not. It doesn't feel like work to you,
it does
right?
Not.
No,
it does not.
Because you enjoy it, and
not.
I can really see that.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Well, because you can't have, normally, this type of conversation can't happen when you're out having drinks.
No.
Why? Because you're distracted. There's
exactly.
other people, you're sharing conversations with people. But to sit here one-on-one and be able to tap into just a little bit of what you have to offer, it's amazing. And I know the audience is absolutely going to be just taken back by this. Because honestly, brother, the chances of me having a nuclear physicist on the show, to me, this is a benchmark, brother. This is, to go 70 episodes and to finally get to this point where I could have somebody at your caliber to be. And I hope I'm not saying, but it's just, to me, I'm just honored and flattered that you're here, man.
Okay.
I really appreciate
Thank
this.
You.
And I just, you know, before we go, I mean, we're already an hour into the show, but just before we go anywhere,
I'm not going anywhere.
You mentioned something really interesting the other day. We were talking about weddings in
Scotland.
So we can't go without talking about this. So typically here, when you get married, you usually do the stag shower, and then, you know, then you have the wedding, and then you go to the reception, and then you have the reception, and everybody gets shit-faced, and everybody goes home, and it's over, right?
Yeah.
And the bride and groom goes on a vacation. Scotland, it's a little different, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You guys do like a double down on that, right?
Yeah, so, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, so if you're, the wedding itself will be, normally take place, let's say, from like 11 a.m., but that will go all the way till about 1 a.m. the following day, right? And then even after that, people might be going to their hotel rooms and whatever. They might be carrying on the party after the place is closed, right?
Yeah.
But you normally, like, let's say, for example, you've got like a church wedding, right? Let's just say you've got a church wedding.
Yep.
normally the service might start at 11 a.m. and then you'll go afterwards, you'll go to some drinks reception. So you'll be standing there around, maybe chatting to some people. There'll be canapes going around and you'll be having some drinks. Then immediately after that, you might sit down for a meal together and then you'll have all the speeches and stuff like that. And that might be, I guess, like the part where you're it's exact same as your reception, right?
Exactly, yes.
But afterwards, there will be an additional thing that will happen whereby you will invite guests. And Americans find this very strange, okay? But you'll invite an additional set of guests that are maybe not so close to you.
Okay.
But they'll come for like an evening part of the thing and it will turn into like a bit of a disco.
Wow.
Right. And there'll be food provided. Like, you know, in my wedding, for example, we had a proper sit down meal, but in the evening we had a barbecue that was then provided, you know, so people could get burgers and hot dogs and things like that. So people who just arrived could benefit from that. And then anyone who's still hungry from the earlier meal could also take advantage of that too. But the party continues on till about 1 a.m, something like that. But the key part about this that's very different in Scottish weddings is that when we're at the service itself, most of the men, if not the ladies, will have what we call a hip flask. Okay, so basically just like typically like it might be like a pewter or something like this, but basically a silver metal canister, which is with whiskey. So you've got the good stuff in there. So you'll get people that are already at 11 a.m. swigging on this. So you're talking about a whole continuous day of drinking.
Wow. So can the people from the wedding reception, let's say we'll call it the reception, can they stay for the second part?
Oh, they have to stay. I mean, it's almost there.
So it just gets massive. All these people.
Well, so I'll give you just the numbers for ours. Ours was about 80 people we invited. Yeah, it was a relatively small one. I've been in much, much larger in Scotland.
Yeah.
It was about 80 people for the main meal. Mm-hmm. And then we asked an additional 20. So it didn't get like out of hand, you know? But it goes up by about 25% typically. What I mean?
Right.
So you invite something like a quarter of the original ones come, and then they might just be like work colleagues and things like that.
Okay.
You know?
So let me ask you, so why shouldn't I be offended that I was invited to party two, but I wasn't invited to the wedding?
Good question. I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
And nobody's offended by it,
No, it's completely accepted.
Here, people be fighting, people be mad, like, why did I get invited? That's exactly what
would happen. I've heard this from multiple people.
Yeah, I'm telling you right now, people would be offended. Wow. Why wasn't I invited to the wedding? If I'm good enough for the wedding, why am I good enough for the second party?
Yeah.
Right? But never really realizing that, hey, listen, you're being invited.
Yeah.
Like, you've been invited to come in and celebrate.
Sure.
So why not just take it for what it is and go celebrate with the people that you love?
Exactly. And I'll also say one thing is that you might provide like a wedding gift that is in proportion to what you've been invited to, right? So maybe, you know, a typical like thing to maybe look out, maybe think about is basically in Scotland at least, is that maybe you cover your plate, right? So basically whatever it might cost for per head, you don't know that.
Yeah.
But if you're going to both of these things, you're thinking maybe a reasonably expensive gift.
Right.
But if you're only invited to the evening, you give a cheaper gift.
Gotcha.
Okay. Does that make sense?
There you go. Yeah,
so you're getting something back from that too. You can go and party with the people.
Yeah.
But you're not necessarily like investing in it in a big way either, right? So no, I can't explain why people aren't offended in Scotland, but I also think, by the way, that in general, people in Scotland are less offended by things.
Right.
And I don't just mean the UK, I mean Scotland.
Yeah.
And I think probably Ireland is similar. But no, we have a way about us. Our culture is like to tendency to not be very easily offended.
Gotcha.
We go with jokes. Jokes are made at our expense.
We
roll with it and we basically give as good back.
We're very uptight here. We are very uptight.
I wouldn't like to say that.
You can make a joke, just can't make a joke about me. You know what I mean? That's usually how it goes. It's funny until it's about me,
that's
usually how it goes.
In Scotland, it's not the case. So I think that we are just less offended, and so that might be one explanation for, you know, what we were just talking about in terms of the second reception.
I found that amazing.
The evening reception.
Yeah. My whole life, I've never heard that before, and to me, it's absolutely amazing. And I think, you know what, we should inherit something like that. You know what I mean? Why not?
Why not? Yeah.
I mean, because usually by 11 o'clock, we're done. You know, the bride and groom do their little dance, and then off they go and they leave.
Yeah.
It's just, it's almost seems like the party's just getting started.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
And, well, there's another part of the Scottish wedding that's very traditional, is that at the very, very end, when the DJ is about to, the last song that the DJ will typically play, at least in the west of Scotland, is a song called The Bonnie Banks of Loch Lomond. So Loch Lomond, loch is the word for lake.
Okay.
So you've heard of Loch Ness, and most of your listeners will have heard of Loch Ness.
Yes.
Now you've got to hear the sound there. It's not loch. It's not loch. Yeah, it's loch. yep. Loch Ness.
Yep.
And there's a really big lake near Glasgow called Loch Lomond, and this is where like a lot of beautiful mountains are. I go climbing there quite a lot. It's absolutely stunning. But anyway, there's this song called "The Bonnie Banks of Loch Lomond," and everyone basically holds hands and you kind of cross your hands. I'm showing Bobby what I'm doing here, but you cross your arms and you hold hands with the people next to you, and then the bride and groom go in the center and you sing this song, and that's typically how they end. But everyone is like they're quite well tippled by that let's say, right?
Yeah, but what a wonderful, beautiful moment, right? Mm. And that's just bathed in tradition, right?
Yes.
Culture and tradition, and you, no matter what, like you go through all this whole process, but you still get that little bit of tradition there, and you end that wedding that way.
Exactly.
What a beautiful story, man. That's amazing.
Thank you.
Real quick, before we get out of here,
yeah,
what's the future look like for you? What do you, you know, obviously you're at where you're at. Mm-hmm. Where do you see yourself 5 years from now? What's the impact?
Okay, I would like to eventually become a professor. So what I want to say about that is actually that in the US, I think that all the people at my level are typically just called professors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But in the UK, it means like it's essentially a promotion at some point, right?
Okay.
And I would like to get to there. So it means a higher salary and it means a few other things. But that's where I would like to be. But I have a few ideas that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. I'm working on an idea for cancer treatment that I want to get funded.
Really?
And I would like to see that eventually becoming part of the way that many people are treated in terms of their cancers.
Really?
I think it really offers a lot.
I could do a whole
separate podcast about that.
Absolutely.
And then I have another idea for something that I would like to actually build in the US. There's a new facility in Michigan called FRIB. So FRIB, it's a facility for radioactive ion beams. And basically it's an enormous facility that the US government is funding. And it's going to offer us the best beams of atomic nuclei that we've ever had, right, in the world. And I would like to build something that I can then bring to the US to do some studies with these beams. So I'm looking to get that funded. So in 5 years, I would like to have my cancer research project having been funded and having a bunch of talented people working under me working on that go with it, guys. And then on the same side, I would like to do something that's much more fundamental as well. So part of my research is like applied.
Okay.
So someone benefits directly from it, and another part of it's just like, well, what the hell is going on with this little atomic nucleus, right?
The thing at the center of the atom, like a particle collider, right?
That's it. Yeah. I want to use a particle collider in Michigan, East Lansing, Michigan, basically. Yeah, I would like to see those projects having been funded in 5 years' time, and those would be underway, and we'd be making progress
with
them.
You could potentially change the world. You have the, right? There's a potential you could literally change the course of mankind. That's amazing. That's really amazing.
Perhaps, yeah. I don't know if I would put it quite in those worlds, but I guess in my own small way. But then in the same way, you're making changes. You're making changes to people's lives in many things that many of us do, we are making changes, positive changes to the world. And that could be measured in terms of, well, I built this thing and it's benefited someone. Or you could say, I've created a podcast, for example, that's benefited, you know, X number of people's lives. So I think in the same way that I'm changing the world, you are too, Bobby.
Thank you, sir.
So I don't think you should necessarily just look at me going, you're changing the world, and sitting there going, I'm not. Because you are doing it as well, you know.
Thank you, sir.
It's just through a different means.
Right. And you know, I think we both share that passion for mankind. Like just how do we get better? Because it's never about, you know, what am I doing? It's about what are we doing? And, you know, and I always say one person at a time, right? If you can reach, I always said, if I could sit in this, behind this microphone and I could just reach one person, then I'm winning.
Yeah.
That's the whole plan. That's the idea. Because for me, I always say to myself, what can I leave behind? What's my legacy?
Yes.
Right? How is it that I can just a little bit of change in the world that maybe we can be a little better tomorrow, right? Just, you know, not so much yesterday, but what's tomorrow look like?
Yes.
And, you know, the idea that you and I are sitting here and having this conversation, man, and just talking about some of the things we talked about tonight, this is exactly my dream. This is what I was talking about all those times, 69 episodes. And to get here and having these conversations to actually say to yourself, you know what? It's so much bigger than just us.
Yes.
You know, we're just each one single human together collectively.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful, amazing anomaly that you could never replicate.
No.
You know, individually, I think we're weak. Together, there's nothing we can't do.
I agree.
You know what I mean? There's nothing we can't do. And I think talking about these situations and making people aware that we can make a change. And never thinking to yourself for one second that your life isn't important enough or you don't have the capacity to do something different. Really, honestly. Even if it's walking an old lady across the street.
Yeah.
You know, even if it is volunteering in your community. I always say it. It starts with your community.
Yes.
That's where it starts for everybody. You don't have to go and move a building or a mountain.
No.
All you have to do is participate. You know, give a shit about the people that live next door to you. Give you 5 minutes to just say, hey, you know what? Let me go and coach a baseball team, right? Mm-hmm. Because every one of those kids, you're going to change their lives. You're going to be a memory that they're going to carry forever.
Yes.
You know? So just realizing and harnessing that, I think that power, to your point, either you're a nuclear physicist, you're a podcaster,
yeah,
or you're on a ship and you're getting lobsters. You know what I mean?
Like, exactly.
You're making a difference, you know? Yeah. And I think all of that collectively, I think it's really, it's the evolution of mankind, man.
Yeah,
I really believe that. I truly, honestly believe that. And I think we're becoming more and more in touch with our reality and our existence. We recycle. We're more sensitive to our environment. We care about, you know, animals that are dying.
Mm-hmm.
Like all of those things that we're becoming sensitive to, and it's taken us so long. I mean, the Industrial Revolution just ravaged and raped this world. I mean, we literally took every resource we could and nobody even cared the consequences of that.
Right.
And I think finally we're starting to make some difference. You know, obviously, there's still a lot of things happening in other countries that they don't care about the world the way we do.
Yeah.
But I think the collective, the larger collective, does care.
Sure. I think those other countries you talk about, they might just be behind the schedule a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Because they might just be catching up. Yep. You know, we look at our countries and we were the pioneers for all of this Industrial Revolution stuff that you talked about.
But
these ideas will probably reach these other countries, maybe. Maybe in the next 50 years or something like that. I hope so.
You know, because I think like Brazil. Brazil to me comes to mind. Because I think Brazil, they're a little more advanced.
Yes.
But still, they don't have the concept of, hey, listen, recycle. You know what I mean? Like, don't throw your trash in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I think, obviously, some of the most beautiful country, like the landscape is beautiful. The best beaches in Rio de Janeiro, like all of that's beautiful. But you know, you drive out a little bit, and you know, even Ecuador, like little Ecuador, they back up their dump trucks to the river and they dump their, like, and you say to yourself, what does it take? How do we get to these people? You know what I mean? And I think to your point, it's them getting evolved enough where they have the technology and the means to do so, to care and do those things. But I think eventually we'll get there. But I think the larger, the superpowers of the world, let's say, I think they're becoming more and more conscious. And
I
think
agree.
Us together, spreading that word, we're making a difference. I really do believe that.
Okay.
And I think our children will be even more sensitive than we are.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, without question.
I see it in my students already. You know, they talk about things that I never talked about 20 years ago. You know, they're much more conscious of the environment and so on. Yeah,
sure.
So
sure.
I agree with you on that. 100%.
And I think the availability of information, like we talk about smartphones, we talk about computers. At any moment, I remember growing up, and I'm sure you'll agree, if someone said something, you had to take their word for it.
Yeah, right.
You know, right?
Yeah.
And they would say something crazy, you'd be like, really?
Yeah.
Now you literally pick up your phone and you Google it, you know
that's BS.
That's
dude.
BS, man. You're lying to me. That's not true.
Yeah.
So I think that in itself, again, one more time, let's say it one more time, the evolution, and I think our children in this generation, your students, have that information, so they're going in much more zeroed in and zoned in and conscious of this, as opposed to being someone coming in and not knowing any idea. Like, you're going to teach me the English language. No, they already know the English language. Now we're going to use the English language for them to learn what it actually means to be at unison with your world, with your existence.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Wow.
What a great episode, man. This is unbelievable.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed myself.
We're going to do this again. You know what? And next time you visit, and even though you're in Scotland, we can do this over the phone.
Yeah, sure.
I would love to do this
again. Well, just hit me up when you're ready to, you know.
I want to hear about your cancer research.
Okay.
I would love to talk about that, and I would love to spread the word on that. And you know what? And honestly, if we can get the word out there and maybe some funding, whatever it takes.
You know, I could put it on a funding application, say it was on a podcast, so yes.
That would be amazing.
Why not?
We could spread the word, right? That'd be fantastic, man. I'm very receptive to that. I spent a lot of time. I worked with a medical company, and part of that was an oncology center. So I worked with the LINAC machine.
All right.
And that changed my life. I mean, being around, and not that anybody hasn't been affected by any way, shape, or form, you have been affected by cancer,
whether
somebody directly or indirectly. But I never was sensitive to it until I was actually involved in it and realizing how critical time was. You know, you couldn't be in a situation where someone wasn't getting their treatments, because the difference between them having another week or not having another week was being able to be treated. You know what I mean? And And I think, you know, when you think about how technology and people like yourself have developed these technologies that literally save lives every day, mm-hmm. and we take that for granted. And had I not seen that for myself and been involved in that personally, I probably would never have been aware of how important and critical that is to, you know, that grandparent, that mom,
yes.
You know, that dad, that child,
yes.
you know, having just a little more time, mm-hmm. just, and that little, you know, and again, I'll say this, there's a lot of things in life that you can exchange, you can trade, but time, we're all given time.
Yes.
And you never get it back. You know,
and we all experience it at the same rate.
Exactly, man. Right. So what
sometimes it might not feel like it, right? When you're sitting doing something interesting,
right.
it's fast.
Right.
When you're sitting doing something boring, it's slow. But right. unfortunately, we all experience it at the same rate.
Right, right, right. And so the idea that you're using all of your knowledge and all of your education to help save lives, man. That to me is just, I didn't know that.
Let's hope so. And I think that for a potential future podcast, I think that your knowledge of having worked with the LINAC would actually be good because it is going to be, it's a radiotherapy. It's an evolution of radio, the current the radiotherapy that I'd be working on. You know, right. it's not like an idea that like something that Albert Einstein would have where it's completely revolutionizing it, but it's a step that would then help people to identify what type of cancer it is, how is it progressing, how is it likely to progress. And it's information that oncologists at the moment don't have.
Right,
having your knowledge already of, you know, of LINACs and how they work and whatever and what they offer to people, that would be quite good.
Right, yeah. And, you know, and the thing is that it was always about target treatments where, mm-hmm. you know, at one time, you would just give them radiation.
You go
in a room and we're going to bombard you with radiation. And if you don't know, I mean, it literally kills all your cells.
Yeah.
Now you target that. With LINAC, you had the ability to zero in and exactly, you know, you would do the CT scan.
Yes.
Right? They would identify the locations of where that cancer was. And now you're able to just pinpoint those areas.
Yeah.
And now you're only affecting that area as opposed to the whole body.
Right.
So literally changing, like giving people longer lives and less
side effects.
Exactly. Yeah. The side effects of that radiation. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So again, that started with somebody like you, man. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
You know, you say that, you know, if it's that little bit that makes the difference, that makes the change, that so now we're not no longer going in a room and just being bombarded with these gamma rays. Now it's a matter of you're literally be able to find that. And,
yes.
And so, you know, when you say it, that little bit, David, that little bit can make all the difference in the world. And then, like you said, then you have your colleagues who say, hey, I see that.
Mm-hmm.
And how about this?
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And now you're fish bowling, and next thing you know, you guys have a cure for cancer, man.
Yeah. That's the hope, isn't
right?
it? Yeah, that's
right?
the hope.
That'd be amazing, man.
Yeah.
David, I want to say thank you so very much for being here.
No, you're very welcome, Bobby.
One, it's an absolute pleasure and honor to call you my friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that, you know, we can do this again real soon.
I would enjoy that.
I know it's a 3,000-mile journey for you in either direction, but I hope that I can get to Scotland myself and, you know, we can spend some time out there. And,
right.
Again, when you come back.
Well, you've always got a place to stay in Glasgow,
man,
if you do come and visit us.
My man, I love to hear that. Yeah, absolutely. And we'll have to do something, man. I can't wait. I mean, it's just the idea that we found each other. You know what I mean? And it's just, it's amazing. You know, we were together the other night, and I just, real quick before I walk us out of here, I was sitting at that table, and a month ago, 2 months ago, I didn't know any of you. None of you.
Right, yeah.
And here I am sitting at the table, and I'm having this amazing, unbelievable conversation with people, including yourself,
mm-hmm.
and I say to myself, this is the universe.
Yeah, this is what makes life good, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and I miss that. And it was for so long that I kind of removed myself. And, you know, I mentioned in a couple of episodes where I wasn't social. And I love to talk, you know, and I get on the podcast and I could talk and I got people in the show. But out in public, I was almost introvert. You know, mm-hmm. like I was almost, I wouldn't look at you. I kind of, you know, I'm target zero in where I'm going. I'm mm-hmm. going to the grocery. Now I walk everywhere and people want to talk to me.
Like, yeah.
I've almost like lifted the shield, and
right.
for some reason, just people just want to have conversation, and I miss this very, very much. And the idea that we're here today, and the idea that we shared that evening, and mm-hmm. just to me, life couldn't be better, my man.
Yeah.
Like, I'm living my best life.
Great.
I really am.
I'm really pleased to hear that, Bobby. I mean, I've only known you for a very short time, but I can see you're very effusive, you're very happy guy. Yeah, so yeah, I'm just pleased to hear that you're in a good place.
Well, thank you, sir. Yeah. Look, is there anything you want to mention on the show? Is there, like, if anybody wanted to reach out to you or had or interested in anything, is there anything?
No, I'm happy just to be here. Awesome. Not necessarily looking for any follow-ups or anything like that. Awesome. But if anyone does want to contact me, then they can do so through you, I guess, through your podcast.
Absolutely.
I'll give you my details and you can then forward anything on. If they do want to, I'll be happy to, but I'm not going to push anything.
Yeah, you never know. People might have questions, you know.
Exactly.
People might just, or somebody might know something.
Yeah,
or,
if they do want to talk, contact me, then do it through you. Absolutely. But I'm not going to push anything or give anything out there.
Awesome. Well, you know, if the audience already, they should be aware by now. If they want to reach out to me, it's thebobbycudoshow@gmail.com. Of course, they can go to the website, thebobbycudoshow.com. Or give me a call, 508-475-9499. Leave a message. And, you know, I'm very grateful to be here, and I'm so grateful that you're here. And I just can't wait to see what 71 looks like, 72. And, you know, episode 200, man. I just keep saying, like, just the momentum is unbelievable. The audience is receptive. And I think we're delivering a clear message to people that life can be good, man. You just got to get out of your own way.
Absolutely.
You just have to get out of your own way. You know what I mean? Like, you know, people will say it all the time. Oh, college, 4 years. Listen, I blink. 4 years just went by. You know what I mean? Like, literally, you blink and it's gone. And to be able to say to yourself, you know what, I invested in myself and I'm going to be a better person tomorrow, whatever that may be, whatever it is.
Exactly.
You could go to bartending school. Like, go do it. Yeah. Like, why are you going to work and hating your life every
day?
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I only say that because I was there. I lived it. And I'll never do that again, man. Mm-hmm. I will never do that again. Yeah. You know? And here I am, and I'm literally bathing in my happiness, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's
like, I almost feel guilty about it, but I don't. So, David, thank you very much for being here, bro.
You're
really,
welcome,
really
Bobby.
Appreciate
thank you for the invitation.
Have a safe trip home. I mean, just, you guys are leaving this weekend?
Yeah, on Sunday evening.
On Sunday, so it's really critical to get you in here.
Absolutely.
When we did. So I really appreciate you taking the time, and, you know, obviously it's your vacation, and to come into the studio.
Oh,
I know it's a little warm in here. I'm actually working on some AC. We got to get out of here before we pass out. So everybody, please don't forget to reach out. Remember, the Patreon, thebobbycudoshow.com. Go check it out. And I really appreciate everybody being here. And remember, everybody, always remember that all roads lead here.